Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here with us. Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We are going to be talking with the Legal Aid Justice Center here today. Kindly, two representatives, Kim Rola and Adiola Agunkede. Yeah. How in the world I got that right the first time. Props to me. We are going to be talking about what the Legal Aid Justice Center does, a specific program that Kim and Adiola take care of for them, the Civil Rights and Racial Justice Program. But obviously, the events of August 12th here in Charlottesville are still warm and painful in our hearts and minds. And the Legal Aid Justice Center has some feelings about that as well. So we'll be talking with Kim, an attorney in the Civil Rights and Racial Justice Program at the Legal Aid Justice Center, and Adiola, the legal director of the Civil Rights and Racial Justice Program, again at the Legal Aid Justice Center. You can find the center at Justice for All. That's the number four. Justice, number four, all.org. More justice, less poverty. So, good morning, ladies. Welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Morning.
I appreciate you being here. So, August 12th, certainly a difficult time for many people. Can I ask, were the two of you downtown on the 12th?
I was, as a spectator, I guess, if that's what you could call it. But I was there on August 12th for some of the morning, yes.
And this is Kim.
I live in Richmond now, but I actually lived in Charlottesville for 7 years, and I only moved to Richmond in August 2016. So I actually come back on August 11th to provide legal support with the National Lawyers Guild as a legal observer. So I was present at the Terror Torch March, as Adiola has think very aptly referring to Friday evening as, and I was also present from 7 a.m. onward at Emancipation Park and downtown.
So I want to make sure to get stories and imagery that from what you saw on those days, on those nights. And before we go any further, I want to make sure that people recognize that Wake Up Call and WPVC remember and recognize Heather Heyer and Jay Cullen and Burke M.M. Bates and the others that are injured. We keep talking about Heather Heyer and a lesser degree the death of the two troopers, but there were a lot of people who were injured, and sometimes they get overlooked because of the more serious, the death of Heather Heyer, and everybody needs to be remembered for what happened to them in a negative way. What they put out there by being downtown. But I want to start with what the Legal Aid Justice Center has specifically brought forth into the conversation. you put out a press release calling out the law enforcement response on August 12th, and I guess August 11th too, the Terror Torch March. Was that the phrase?
Yeah.
They used words that were used and phrases such as indifference to safety, failed to intervene, and disappointing. Talk about that.
So I'll start by saying that I, as a lawyer with the Legal Aid Justice Center, I don't necessarily want my voice to be a voice and my specific personal observations to be the voice that transcends the voice of the community that we serve. I was there on Saturday for several hours of the morning. I would say I got to Charlottesville about 9:30, a little bit before 9:30, and then left about, was able to make my way out, wend my way out about around 1 o'clock. And so I do have my own specific personal observations of what went on Saturday. I wasn't there Friday night. And I did see for myself what went on, but also as an organization, Legal Aid Justice Center, that prides itself on being responsive to community needs, and that's the vantage point from which our statement is made, we went through a process with respect to what happened on August 11th and August 12th. Our process is the same as any other process when we're considering an issue that's brought to our attention and making a decision whether or not it matches up with our organizational values and it's an issue for which we would like to advocate. And that process included talking, you know, doing due diligence, talking to witnesses, talking to the people who were there firsthand, reviewing objective evidence, video. I'm sure the listeners are aware that so many people were on the ground taking video of the events on Saturday and Friday as they unfolded. And those videos were posted to social media, traditional media. And at LAJC, we went over and we looked at those videos and we were able to match up what we saw with our understanding of the law, our understanding of policy, our understanding of best practices when it comes to police action and police response, and being informed by our organizational values. Once we did that due diligence, we were, you know, guided by that to then come out and make the statement that was made. I believe you're referring to a statement that was released on Thursday of last week, and or now today, Sunday, the week before. And so that language that you're referring to, indifference, that language that's in the statement, that language that you're referring to is based off of an evaluation that follows our process, that follows our process in every type of case and all type of advocacy that we take up, whether it's for a particular client or around a particular issue. Our investigation and looking at, you know, what was out there led us and guided us to those conclusions that are reflected in the statement. And so once you see what is documented and what witnesses relate about the law enforcement response, it appears to us, and it was apparent, that there was a seeming indifference. I'm not sure if, you know, people can quibble over words, but what was apparent to us was indifference. And what was the feeling that was projected after doing our due diligence, after reviewing that information, was one of disappointment that would be the response. Obviously, I understand that there's going to be a review, an independent investigation into that response. That was recently announced by the city, and that review will give more insight. But without additional information, what our investigation and what our process revealed was seeming indifference, and that is disappointing.
What has been the feedback since that came out? I mean, the Legal Aid Justice Center, certainly a well-respected organization in this town, and in a larger area, I mean, you want to go statewide, regionally, but certainly just in Charlottesville, a well-respected organization whose goals, whose efforts are looked at as dynamic, as with a great mission, and then you come forth with this statement saying that the police didn't do their job. I mean, that's really what it boils down to, is saying they stood there and didn't do anything when they could have, should have, might have. What has been the feedback?
I think that, as you're, I think, alluding to in your question, that, you know, criticizing law enforcement is a sensitive area. And, you know, that the feedback we've received has certainly been indicative of that. From some of our organizational stakeholders, I think that this is a difficult conversation to have, particularly when we attempt to contextualize what happened on August 11th and 12th in Charlottesville in broader institutions of white supremacy. I think, you know, it's a little bit easier to have the conversation about Nazis. There seems to be a general consensus in America that, you know, we don't like Nazis, but, you know, though there's been some statements by high-level officials that maybe are more ambiguous than most Americans would like. But I'll just leave that alone. I think that
you don't have to.
When we
not on this program, not on this radio station.
But when we try to contextualize what happened on August 11th and 12th in broader systems of white supremacy, I think, as our client community has asked us to do, right? I'd like to. I think Adiola made a really, you know, a strong point in framing this conversation that really, you know, we both have experiences as individuals who are community members who directly experienced the horror and the terror of that weekend. But also our job is as legal representatives for our client community. And we have really listened to the accountability, the truth that they need before being able to heal. You know, that's a lot of the conversations that happened in the city council meeting last Monday about how our community will come together and heal. And I think the first step to that is truth, is accountability, that is also mentioned in the press release. So, you know, we really, one of the demands from Solidarity Seville is, you know, to address, for example, racially disparate stop and frisk. The fact that there are, you know, I might actually think of the numbers in front of me.
That 71%, I think, is the number.
Yeah, you're released. 9 times more likely to be stopped by the police and frisked
in Charlottesville
if you're black than if you're white. And I think that, you know, the response that we heard from the community and what they needed and wanted us to address as legal representatives was the relationship to law enforcement, to the entire community of Charlottesville, how the law enforcement here in Charlottesville is or is not accountable to the whole community. And certainly, you know, as the name of our program, Civil Rights and Racial Justice, you know, that has a specific racial dynamic that is, you know, a long, deep story in this country that, you know, touches people's nerves. So I think that that's a long answer to say that we receive pushback. But I think that it's our job as attorneys that that work on behalf of our clients to listen to the issues, not only the issues they experience, what their goals are in response to those. And one of the goals we've heard loud and clear, and I think anyone listening to public meetings, going to the forums that have been held has heard, is that there's a greater need for law enforcement accountability, particularly to communities of color in Charlottesville.
And I think, you know, you spoke to LAJC being well-respected, a well-respected organization whose goals and efforts are looked at as dynamic and with a great mission is how you frame the work that we do. And we appreciate, you know, the way our organization is looked at and viewed in the community, and we take that very seriously. And so we would not speak if we did not think this issue worthy of our advocacy. As you alluded to, the community and beyond, not just, you know, the Central Virginia community, but beyond that, in Virginia at large and, you know, even nationally, LAJC has a reputation for its efforts and it being an organization whose judgment is trusted. And so that we've deemed this an issue worthy of our advocacy is in keeping with our judgment on all the other issues that we advocate around. And we went through the same process and same due diligence and same listening to our clients and our client community that we do for every other issue, and thought, yes, this is an issue on which LAJC, with all its respect, should speak. If not us, who?
18 minutes after the hour here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, talking with Adeola Agunkeide.
That's very good, yes.
And Kim Rolla from the Legal Aid Justice Center. Currently talking about August 12th here in Charlottesville. I think that's going to become, that's all you have to say now is August 12th for people to know what you're talking about. We'll be getting in later in the hour into their civil rights and racial justice program and some of the important things that are being done in that program as well. Going to take our break just a touch early so we don't interrupt the next part of the conversation. We'll be right back. And here we are back in action. Thanks for being with us this Sunday. An important conversation with representatives from the Legal Aid Justice Center, Kim and Adeola. So, ladies, the press release that came out, I don't have it in front of me, and I can't remember whether it said this directly or whether it only implied it through question that the police were asked to stand down. So does the Legal Aid Justice Center believe that the police were asked to stand down on August 12th?
And your first articulation of it, I think, is correct. The press release puts it as a question and implies it as a question. Was that something that was ordered? Or if not directly ordered, was that something that was discussed as a potential tactic? We don't know. Obviously, we've heard officials come out and expressly deny that any stand down order was given. And at this point, there is no smoking gun that says any such order was given. And so we have that question because that is a question that was asked specifically by members of the community. I was in attendance at the last city council meeting
Six hours. 6 hours,
yeah.
of community members coming forth to say what in the world was going on, and we felt, you know, we felt unsafe, and why weren't you there to make us, why didn't you plan better, and all those sorts of comments and demands and questions and everything else related to what happened.
Right, and there were community members who have that question. There are, you know, community members and groups that we work with directly who want to know, and so that was something that we felt needed to be asked of officials. And so we didn't say, yes, they were ordered to stand down, because we don't have that information. And that is one piece of information, what the specific orders were and weren't, that we'd like to be put out publicly.
Two members of City Council, Mr. Singler, Mr. Bellamy, have done the majority of the talking through the media. Has the Legal Aid Justice Center had better conversation with one than the other? No conversation with either?
I have had no conversation with either Mayor Singler or Vice Mayor Bellamy, but that isn't something that I would couch as, you know, they're avoiding conversation with Legal Aid Justice Center. We have not reached out directly to either. We communicate with all the counselors and city manager and Chief Thomas via the letters that we send to their attention on behalf of the organization.
And I will say that Vice Mayor Bellamy did come to, we hosted an event called Protest the Police and Your Rights, which was intended to give community members basic information about to help them stay safe, to go out and demonstrate. And Vice Mayor Bellamy did come out and attend part of that as an audience member. But as I think Adeola mentioned, we do communicate, you know, to the City Council writ large, and we've done that through letters after both the July 8th KKK rally and a letter on behalf of our client, the Public Housing Association of Residents, that expressed a number of concerns that we sent after August 12th. And we never received a written response to the letter after the July 8th KKK demonstration, and then, you know, very aggressive, militarized police response to counter demonstrators at that rally. We never received a written response from City Council. And Adeola, you should correct me if I'm wrong. I don't believe we've received anything yet in response to our more recent letter.
I've not heard that there's been a response. In fact, in addition to just sending the letter after the July 8th KKK rally, and community members, voicing their concerns about the police response then, we went to, and I was present for the City Council meeting, I'm forgetting the date, it may have been July 17th, but the last City Council meeting before August 12th, I was present there, as were several members of the Legal Aid Justice Center, including our executive director, Mary Bauer, where she presented the copies of the letter that we had forwarded via mail and via email to the counselors. And she presented and summarized some of the key questions that letter raised and some of the key asks that we had organizationally of counselors and city manager and the chief. And we did not receive a response to that letter. And here we stand.
Have there been internal conversations that you might be able to share any bits of? You know, we talk about whether or not there have been demands or requests for the police, the orders for the police to stand down. And we know that little was done in terms of arresting people on either side. You can go anywhere on social media and watch videos of people picking up, and this is the one that stands out in my head, you know, watching someone pick up a Seville Weekly newspaper box and throw it at someone else 10 feet in front of a police officer. So that is assault, correct? As well as damage to someone, some business's property. and the police officer did nothing. And this is before 11 o'clock, according to the streaming video that I'm watching at the time. And nothing is done. And so obviously tensions are escalating from there. And so the question obviously becomes, why didn't he do anything? Why wasn't that done? So are there internal conversations at the Legal Aid Justice Center that you can share where you're watching these videos, where you're looking at the pictures, where you're sharing your conversations of what you saw that day as you're putting together this press release?
Obviously, you know, we can't speak to our internal conversations that concern our representation of our clients, and we can't speak to our internal conversations about our, you know, legal strategy and legal thinking going forward. But I can just say, you know, personally, I will review something, and if it's not a direct conversation that I'll have with someone like Kim or another colleague, I'll review it. It'll be particularly interesting or striking to me, and then I'll send it, you know, to a colleague and say, did you see this? Did you see this? You know, here's an angle I hadn't seen before. This, you know, gives me view to the officers and how far or really how near they may have been standing to any particular incident. I was, you know, just yesterday struck by a piece in the New York Times. There's a New York Times reporter who had been in town. She may well still be in town, Frances Robles. And she released an article yesterday in the Times about, specifically about the police response. And I've never spoken to Ms. Robles since she's been in town. And she had a piece of video up that I believe at least was attributed to the ACLU of Virginia. I think someone had submitted the footage to their mobile, like, upload site. And it was a picture of a man firing a gun right in front of the steps to Emancipation Park. It appeared that, you know, the aim wasn't specifically to hit anyone, but this is my sort of own personal assessment of it. But he definitely fired a gun in public, open public, on the street. And that angle, I'd never seen that footage before, that angle of the video that was uploaded showed that there were officers, you know, in uniform, in their vests, within what I would assume would be earshot as well as eyeshot of this man firing a weapon. I believe the attribution of who that person was that he was with the Unite the Right groups. Obviously, I don't know specifically. I don't know who that person is, but that was the attribution of it. At least that was the framing that was put on it in the New York Times article. And so, you know, looking at that, for me personally, that was shocking. It was not something that I saw and was present for, but to see that as footage uploaded, I know that article with the video was shared around the office for other people to look at.
I have long-time friends with Coy Barefoot, and he posted something on his social media site yesterday that more people have been arrested in Durham, North Carolina, for taking down a Confederate statue than have been arrested for the beating of DeAndre Harris in Charlottesville, who I believe was a young man beaten in the parking lot on Market Street in Charlottesville on August 12th. And those attackers were photographed and videotaped. In fact, none of those racist thugs have been arrested. Why is justice failing in this community?
Great question, Coy. Great question. I would, you know, echo that question and wonder.
And several of those people, through community and people not associated with police or legal, have tracked those, the people who were doing the beating down, and identified who they were. And yet, at this point, those people have still not been arrested.
I think there's a quote attributed to the city manager in that New York Times article to which I'm referring. And the response was soon, that, you know, people will be arrested with respect to the beating of DeAndre Harris that was photographed, videotaped, and broadcast for all the world to see soon. Obviously, I haven't spoken to this gentleman, but the quote from who I believe to be his lawyer is, soon was 2 weeks ago. DeAndre Harris's lawyer.
Right.
Yeah.
And I don't know DeAndre Harris's financial status, but certainly I would think that his racial status puts him in the category of somebody that Legal Aid Justice Center might represent. You mentioned earlier, Kim, again, our guest today, Kim Rolla, and Adeola Ogunkeda. I think I butchered it that time.
Ogunkeda.
Ogunkeda. From the Legal Aid Justice Center, representing the Civil Rights and Racial Justice Program, that blacks were 9 times more likely to be frisked in Charlottesville, stopped and frisked. So DeAndre Harris falls into that category. And so if he's 9 times more likely to be frisked, he's certainly not 9 times more likely to be assisted when he's in need of help from the police. Is that an awful way for me to phrase that? Am I putting myself on the bad side of law enforcement in Charlottesville when I say that?
I think, again, I would defer to voices of the community members, because I will, since we're on the radio, I will clarify, I am a white person. I lived in Charlottesville for many years, but I experienced law enforcement and the communities I lived in as a white person and as a professional class white person who is an attorney. But I worked for many years very closely with the Public Housing Association of residents who've had experiences. I would say I've spoken with a number of individuals who have experiences of over policing in their communities. And the first thing that comes to my mind with your question is actually a community member that spoke at the city council meeting last Monday during the collective outpouring of grief and anger that you described earlier. And she asked why it would be that at 6th Street, at a public housing site, the officers would appear on a dime and clear the entire community for a dice game for people gambling, and run everyone out of the neighborhood that is out in public while that's happening. And yet, so many community members could experience both physical violence and intimidation and terror over that weekend and feel such an absence of law enforcement presence. So I think they're really, I don't know, you said 9 times, and I don't know how to quite quantify whether people feel 9 times less protected. But I think it's a real, again, if this city is serious about healing from August 11th and 12th, it means looking directly at not only white supremacy that we talk about as invaders of our community, but holding a mirror up really closely and asking what vestiges of this country's long legacy of anti-black racism and xenophobia and all of these things still exist here in our institutions. And we're hearing from our client community that they're experiencing that every day, not just August 11th and 12th. And I think, to really move forward, we need to do more deep listening and really, as a community, ask how we are going to hold those institutions accountable to the entire community.
And I think Kim raises a great point, but I'll go back to something you said, Rick, about, are you putting yourself on the bad side of law enforcement? Perhaps by your questioning, you're putting yourself on the right side of justice. It becomes self-reflexive to say, is questioning law enforcement as an institution bad. I think many people have a hesitancy, but it is an institution still that serves the community and that should serve the community. And so where you question its actions, just like people feel it is within their rights to question other agencies and other institutions that serve the community, there is nothing wrong with questioning law enforcement decision making if you're doing it in service of making that a better institution that serves everyone. And so that feeling that you may have, are you putting yourself on the bad side of law enforcement? Right. I think that the better question is, are you putting yourself on the right side of justice when you ask questions and when you feel that there's a need to comment and raise concerns? I think Kim raised a great point about deep listening and listening to the community. August 11th and 12th and July 8th KKK rally, those were flashpoints. But those were flashpoints around a larger conversation that has been going on in the Charlottesville community with respect to low-income communities of color and how they interact with law enforcement as one of many institutions that they rely on and that they must navigate. And so I think for LAJC, as an anti-poverty organization, right, that is our framework. That's the lens through which we look at our work. It is an institution that, like any other institution, RHA, DSS, we should look at and say, how does contact and navigating this institution and this system either exacerbate or perpetuate poverty? You know, there's a saying, an arrest is not just an arrest. Moving away from August 11th and 12th and July 8th, an arrest is not just an arrest. It could lead to consequences such as the loss of housing, the loss of a job, the loss of access to educational loans. And so looking at how the community and specifically communities of color interact with law enforcement and have contact with law enforcement raises you know, issues that are central to LAJC's concern with respect to things that perpetuate and exacerbate poverty or, in general, economic instability in someone's life.
I'm going to ask just one last question, and we'll take our break, and then we'll go into spend the last section of the show talking about the civil rights and racial justice program. And a little bit more about poverty outside of August 12th. What do you think, what does the Legal Aid Justice Center think about the city putting the tarps over the statues downtown?
So we have not, as an organization, had a chance to articulate a response to that.
Right, I have not seen an official center press release.
Yeah, I will say, and again, I know this is kind of becoming a reflexive response to me, but from listening to the community, from, you know, I was not present at the city council meeting, but I did listen to all 6 hours and 8 minutes of the tape, that people don't seem to be satisfied with that. So I will speak as an individual for Kim Rolla that I think that it's certainly, you know, a step forward. It's better than them existing without being shrouded. But I think that, you know, from listening to what community members are calling for, you know, for a long time, it's been not to contextualize the monuments. It's been to remove them. The city council now says that apparently it would be a 5-0 vote now if they were to take it again, that everyone wants the monuments gone. I would point to just, I don't know if it was this weekend or Friday, Attorney General Herring put out an opinion that said he thinks under existing law, any monument that was constructed before 1998, since the law is not written in a retroactive manner, they can be removed. My understanding is that the Lee statue is subject to an injunction. The other one is not, right? I mean, I think that there's, but pulling away from even as you know, myself as an individual, as an attorney. I think if the city is really committed to listening to what residents need and want, again, to be able to have the difficult conversations that will lead to healing, and a clear ask that has come from folks that those statues need to be gone, and they need to be gone as soon as possible. And, you know, there's obviously, I understand that there is, you know, legal terrain that they're navigating, but where there's a will, there's a way, is what I'll say. And there's a lot of soft power that the city council has as well. And I think that we need to really ask, what can everybody bring to bear to make that happen? And, you know, being clear that that's a very small, you know, acute manifestation of white supremacy, and we certainly need to have broader conversations about gentrification and about policing and about, you know, like DSS and all the things that the community members have raised in their 10 demands. But a very clear, direct ask that has come is that the statues need to be gone.
All right. Thanks, Kim. All right. So 11:42 here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. We'll take a break. We're right back. And we'll step aside from August 12th and talk about some of the other projects that go on at the Legal Aid Justice Center. Thanks for listening. All right. And thank you so much for being with us today. An important conversation that we're having with Adeola Agankede.
Yes.
And Kim Rola. I said it with a question mark at the end of it because I haven't pronounced that last name enough times to have it roll off my tongue with flair and confidence yet. But I'm so glad that you're here. Thank you for being with us. Adeola is the legal director of the Civil Rights and Racial Justice Program for the Legal Aid Justice Center. Kim Rola, an attorney in the Civil Rights and Racial Justice Program. And that's what we're going to talk about now, is that program at the Legal Aid Justice Center. You can go there, find it at justiceforall.org. The four is a numeral. Don't spell it out. justiceforall.org. And you can read all about the great work that's done here in Charlottesville. So, 15 minutes left to spend time on this. It deserves a lot more than that. And we'll have you back on in the future to talk about other programs that are done, but we spent a lot of time. It is more justice, less poverty. So I know that there's a couple key things that go on with this program, but let's start by this specific program is fairly new, correct? So what was the need that brought this about to make this program?
So, by way of brief background, I, as the legal director of the program, just started at Legal Aid Justice Center as the program was launched in February of this year. I come from the background of being a public defender. I was a public defender in New York for almost a decade, and that is the background to which I bring, or which I bring to this work. My job as a public defender, I worked at an organization that had an expansive model of public defense, and it was, you know, deemed holistic defense, where I had the opportunity to work with family defense attorneys, civil lawyers, as well as a host of other advocates, non-lawyer advocates, social workers, and parent advocates, to really take a holistic approach to representing clients who had been accused of a crime. Because as people who are aware know, an arrest and contact with law enforcement is never just an arrest. It has deep and far-reaching consequences into someone's life. I think the program was born out of, and in fact, I've heard this from LAJC, and this is why I was attracted to coming to LAJC to take this job. The program was born out of LAJC seeing very much from its direct representation work of people in and around the systems that touch the criminal justice system, that touch the criminal legal system, that in fact there needs to be more of a synthesis between civil legal services and people who work in the criminal justice system, because of the very real and, you know, legal disqualifications and ramifications that an arrest has or that contact with law enforcement has that lead to deep inequities that affect people, push them deeper into poverty, or, you know, wreak economic or economic havoc in their lives in very measurable ways. And so the program was born out of that, and I think seeks to be responsive to the idea of criminal justice reform to decriminalize poverty in the lives of people.
So talk about, I mean, one of the first things that pops up when I go in to do my homework on the program is drive down the debt. So you talk about how one sort of one circle impacts another circle of life. Talk about drive down the debt.
So the interesting thing, or the wonderful thing for me about drive down the debt, is that campaign predates the Civil Rights and Racial Justice Program, and it speaks very much to LAJC having its finger on the pulse of what the client community that LAJC has long represented experiences from contact with law enforcement and contact with the criminal justice system, that illustrates exactly what we mean about decriminalizing poverty. The Drive Down the Debt campaign, which is grounded by, but not solely about, a lawsuit that had been filed against the Department of Motor Vehicles, because Virginia has on its books a law that automatically suspends the driver's license of anyone who has failed to pay court debt. There is no investigation or inquiry into whether or not the failure to pay the court debt is willful, or whether it's really just based on someone's inability to pay because they don't have the money to do so. The suspension is automatic. There's no chance to contest or appeal that suspension before it goes into place. And what we have currently are nearly 1 million, I believe the number is some 900,000 Virginians, who currently have their license suspended either wholly or in part because of their failure, and I use failure as a catch-all phrase, to pay court costs and fees.
So obviously I'm, you know, sort of, I don't want to say struggling, but my inability to understand the larger groups that were here. So the lawsuit is against the DMV, but the DMV to me is just this disembodied organization, and I'm not sure why the DMV would fight back. I mean, is that they don't get any money from this, do they?
I mean,
the people aren't paying the money to the. I would understand if the DMV was the organization that was collecting the fee, and they would say, no. This is how we earn income, but they're not earning income this way, are they?
So. Not that the DMV earns specific income this way. Obviously, the money that's owed is owed to the court system. But the Department of Motor Vehicles, as the way, and this is not to sort of like bog the program down, or
yeah, we don't get, get too
lost,
deep in the weeds.
Like, deep into the weeds with respect to how the statute works. But it's the Department of Motor Vehicle that is responsible for and carries out the suspension of the licenses.
I just don't understand why they wouldn't go, hey, we're on your side, we think this is too much, rather than going, no, we disagree with you, and we're going to fight the lawsuit.
Well, the DMV is, you know, represented by the state in the suit, and so it's the state that is defending.
Okay, so the state is arguing with you, and this is the DMV is just the name
the
of
agency,
the state in
yes.
this representation.
Yes, it's the agency of the state that is named as the authority for carrying out the suspension.
Yeah, so I just had a thought about pulling us out of the weeds a little bit, but when Adiola was saying that, you know, LAJC has by the very nature of our work, we have always worked on the margins of the criminal justice system, right? I mean, she described her background a little bit. I was a housing attorney for 4 years before working in this program. And I can think of countless examples of how the criminal justice system intersected and interfered with people's ability to access safe and stable housing for their families, right? Whether that's criminal background screenings, family members being barred from being on housing authority property because of convictions that occurred years ago. But when this program started and I started to work with Adeola, we talked about, you know, that's at the very... The frame that we used to for the program was that's the very end of the system, right? The conviction already exists. So this program of LAJC is about pulling back and looking at all of the other contact points where we can do to minimize people's contact with the criminal justice system and, you know, basically do harm reduction. Like, I think what she said is so accurate that this is a major, you know... vector of poverty for folks. And I think when we pull back and ask not just, you know, what can we do once someone has a criminal conviction to make sure that they don't have to check a box that removes them from eligibility for employment, or they don't get screened out from public benefits that enable them to feed their children because they have a drug conviction. When we pull back and say, how can we make sure that less people just get into this system? Right. Like when we look at, well, as we started the show talking about why is it that people are having 9 times more contact with law enforcement if they're black in Charlottesville? Or when we look at monetary bail and say, why are people being held in pretrial confinement because they're poor? And when we know that makes them statistically more likely to be convicted if they're held in pretrial confinement. So kind of pulling back and saying more broadly, if we know this is such a vector of poverty, how do we address the inequities in that system, looking at the entire system, right? And not waiting for our clients to come in the door and have already experienced such trauma and damage from that system.
Right, because we know there are built in to the system these enmeshed penalties, such as the disqualifications from housing, from educational loans, from employment, that occur and are automatically triggered, such as the driver's license suspension from failure to pay court debt after a conviction. These sorts of penalties are triggered automatically. They're written into the law. They are legally allowable. And so once someone is already ensnared and trapped by the contact, these penalties then start to grow. These disqualifications from, you know, participating in life fully as a person who lives in this country. And at that point, it's almost too late. It's almost too late. And that's not to say that working to reduce the harm that is caused directly by those enmeshed penalties is not valuable. It is. But we have to work on all fronts. We have to look before our clients ever have that contact to see if we can stop them from being pulled into the system that has these, you know, codified and legalized disqualifications that make them live on the margins of society in ways that you don't if you don't have contact with the criminal legal system.
Sunday morning wake-up call, talking with Legal Aid Justice Center attorneys Adeola Agankede, Kim Rola. A few minutes left in the program. We're talking about the program that they run, Civil Rights and Racial Justice. So you're talking about keeping people out of, as far out of the penalty system as you can. What are you doing now? I mean, everything seems to be written against those in poverty. You're not in the legislative system, so you can't rewrite it. Are you working with people in the legislative system to rewrite the rules? When you go to court, Kim, are you know what is a day in court like for you? Working with the, I realize that's two separate questions. Are you, You know, what is a day like for you working under the current legislative laws that you must deal with? So, Adeola, you answer the first one, please, about trying to get any new laws written. And then, Kim, I'd like to hear from you about being in court.
Yes, we do partner with organizations that do lobbying and do lobbying work and use our deep knowledge of these systems as we work with clients directly to help and lend our voice, their voice really, to the conversation about what a fair and equitable system really looks like and how the law can and should be shaped to reflect that. So LAJC partners and the program, the Civil Rights and Racial Justice Program, partners and hopes to continue to partner with organizations that can do that. We do have, you know, organizational goals and organizational capacity to go and be a part of the legislative process. And so that is something, that is one of the tools, legislative advocacy, that we use. I think because LAJC has such an expansive toolkit, direct representation, systemic litigation, legislative and policy advocacy, as well as community organizing, we pull on and we draw from any one of those tools to be able to influence change where we think necessary and where we think and learn from our clients will have the greatest benefit to them.
All right, so we have a little less than a minute for Kim to tell me about how you deal with the rules that you have.
So I think that Adeola's point is a really important one, that we have a very diverse toolkit at Legal Aid Justice Center, and that's one of the reasons that I so value working here. I would say, so you ask a day in the life, I was actually in court a lot more as a landlord-tenant attorney, and one of the things that I think is wonderful about this new program is how deep the relationships with the community are already. So I'll tell you very briefly about a little of the work we've done in Richmond, where we're working with two membership-based organizations that of our client population of low-income folks that have identified as a goal for their community to have a civilian review board for the Richmond Police Department, one mechanism that a community could choose to use to try to increase accountability of a police department. And we can come in as attorneys and help answer questions about how does that happen, right? What you know, who makes that happen in the locality, right? It doesn't have to be necessarily the General Assembly, but under things like the Dillon Rule that will pull us into the weeds, like who has the authority to make that decision? What are the pressure points? You know, being present for people to, with the community to hear their goals and then offer our legal skills for them to sharpen their campaigns. And, you know, sometimes that does look like litigation. It may look like large scale federal litigation. Sometimes it looks like defensive cases in general district court. But one of the great things about LAJC is that we know sometimes it looks like being in community meetings to be present with folks, listen, and answer questions when needed. So I think that this program is showing up as we're needed right now in what's a very important historical moment in Central Virginia.
Ladies, not enough time, but I hope that means you'll come back in the future.
Definitely. Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Adeola Agankede, I butchered it at the end. Kim Rowa from the Legal Aid Justice Center. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thanks, you.
Rick.
Next week, the president of Piedmont Virginia Community College will be here. Hope you'll tune in. Thank you.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fugits of Tiger Fuel, production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.